Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn, the podcast. My medical school yearbook was called Anomalies and Curiosities of Medicine. Go Davis. And, well, let me just say that today's stories could be filed under the title of Curiosities and Pitfalls of Medicine. So let's get started with some curiosities and pitfalls. And one of the big themes for today is epidemiology as a pitfall, and also a little bit about why that is so often the case. So we're going to start with an article that is a large meta-analysis. This was from a press release by the Institute of Food Technologists, so there might be a little bit of, shall we just say, industry influence there. But that being said, this looked at many studies, 1,277 to be exact, for coffee and its effect on human health. What they were able to establish with this was if your coffee consumption consists of 3 to 4 cups. Now, I would point out that these are 8-ounce cups of regular coffee. So if you are a regular coffee shop aficionado, you probably want to make that a maximum of 2, given the higher serving sizes. But let's call it 2 cups of your favorite coffee chain a day is neutral. More than that might have some adverse effects. And the studies looked at things like total mortality, cardiovascular disease, metabolic health, that's to say diabetes, cancer, neurologic disorders, and GI conditions. And they really didn't find any consistent evidence that that was a toxic dose or a bad dose. Now, one of the pitfalls of these meta-analyses, and again, we're talking about pitfalls in science and medicine, is that when you combine a bunch of studies, there are subtle differences between how those studies are performed. And I want to point out one in my own knowledge. This one was done in the early 90s. And in the 80s, there'd been a number of studies that showed that coffee consumption increased your risk of heart disease and raised your cholesterol. Primarily, they were using cholesterol as a secondary marker, a surrogate marker, because you could study that with a shorter turnaround time than heart attacks, obviously. And the studies in the 80s had found an inconsistent but somewhat concerning connection between higher consumption of coffee and higher cholesterol. Another study done in the 90s had the opposite results, but then some clever person actually went and looked in the methods section, something I highly recommend when you're trying to understand the scientific literature, and they discovered that the way that the coffee had been made was different. Most of the studies in the 80s, which showed a positive association, were percolator coffee, which uses a metal filter. Most of the studies that showed a negative association were paper filter studies. And studying the difference between coffee that's made by these two methods, the researchers discovered that if you use a metal filter, coffee contains an oily compound called diterpene. And these various diterpenes do have a mild cholesterol-raising effect. On the other hand, if the study was done with a paper filter, the paper absorbed the diterpenes. And you can observe this yourself when you look at a cup of coffee that's been made with a metal filter, say, oh, an espresso or an Americano, and there'll be a little greasy oil slick on the top of that coffee while you're looking at those diterpenes. Now, isn't it fascinating that it's not the coffee itself, but the method of preparation that influenced the outcome of those studies? And this is a classic example of how we can get into trouble with epidemiology, because we stack together a whole bunch of slightly different methodological approaches. And the same thing is true when we do drug studies, looking for whether this agent is effective. Now, we know that there's a great deal of genetic variation, but we do drug studies on the general population, and therefore we're ignoring the effects of that genetic variation. In my opinion, everyone who is in a drug study should have their genome analyzed, because there are a number of factors that we could probably learn about or already know about that could correlate with a very strong positive response for drugs. We would be able to turn up drugs for orphan diseases, and we could go back through all of the drugs that were promising in animals but rejected in humans and probably discover that if you have this particular pattern of a drug detoxifying enzyme, this drug is not for you because it causes adverse side effects. But if you don't have that pattern, it's an extremely effective agent and very safe. We need to be doing this kind of research in order to be sure that we aren't fooling ourselves due to the problem of aggregation. It works both ways. You can come up with effects that are seemingly important, but clinically just not meaningful. And you can come up with effects that seem to be negative, but actually are missing a very, very important and effective clinical pearl. Well, I, like most people who spend a lot of time in my head, are always looking for memory enhancement and performance enhancing drugs. I'm sorry. I have to admit it's a guilty pleasure of mine to read those nootropic websites and read about this, that, or the other thing that's supposedly going to enhance my cognitive function. Now, I don't generally play around with those with myself. I've already discovered from the use of migraine agents and look at my own DNA that I have a fairly aberrant physiology when it comes to drug breakdown. And I can get into real trouble with some of these agents, especially the ones where the side effects really haven't been studied relative to their breakdown. But this latest agent might be something I would give a try to. A recent, very well-done study looked at methylene blue and MRI-based response in brain areas. This was short-term memory and attention. And the researchers were able to show that a single dose of methylene blue caused a 7% increase in correct responses during memory retrieval. This is the long-term contextual memory that they were testing. So remembering the details of an event that occurred a while back. And they looked at cerebral blood flow to an area called the bilateral insular cortex. This is an area deep within the brain that we've previously associated with emotional responses. But it turns out to also really light up when you give methylene blue, and the visual processing center is stimulated. And it's, as we said, associated with a 7% increase in performance. Well, that's enough. I can tell you, as a recovering medical student, that's enough to kick you from a B to an A. And so that makes my little hairs on the top of my ears prick up. This was done with a low dose and a single dose. And I went and read the Wikipedia page on methylene blue. I highly recommend it if you are thinking about playing with this stuff. There is an over-the-counter agent that has it. I will not name it here, but we've given high doses of methylene blue in multiple different circumstances. It's even been used as an anti-malarial by the troops during World War II. What they ended up with was blue urine and the blue and the whites of their eyes, which reminds me a little bit of the movie Dune. But in any event, the idea here is that some of these performance-enhancing agents may actually have fairly low toxicity. And when I have patients who ask me about this, I tend to tell them, look, we know that DHA, which is a component of omega-3 fatty acids, helps membrane fluidity and enhances performance. We know that phosphatidylserine and phosphatidylcholine, likewise, two very benign agents found in lecithin, improve performance in blinded clinical trials. And I feel these compounds are completely safe for any individual. When you're talking about perhaps a person who is on blood thinners, you might have to reduce the dose of DHA or monitor their bleeding time. But aside from that, I think these are reasonable agents to use, particularly in people with mild cognitive dysfunction who are seeking to prevent deterioration. And the other thing I recommend to those individuals very strongly is exercise to the greatest capacity. Push your muscles in particular, because that releases a compound in the brain that increases the growth of new synapses. And we don't have a drug that does that. And all of these nootropics mostly seem to work by increasing blood flow, which is not a bad thing, and it's probably affecting switching and revving up those areas of the brain. But the reasoning is a bit backwards. We're reasoning from effect to cause, and we may be missing something very important in terms of the long-term benefit of most of the nootropic agents. So I'm not encouraging the use of those. So we're switching now to another pitfall in science, and that is, well, the situation that we have in this country where we're playing catch-up with all of the chemicals that have been released into the environment since the post-World War II era. It's a great big problem because we really do not know about the effects of these agents in humans, and in particular in the most vulnerable humans of all, which is to say the gestating human who's still inside another human's body. This latest report was published this week in the International Journal of Epidemiology. I found it in a press release from the Oxford University Press on the Science Daily website, which is where many of my stories are drawn. This study reported an association between the use of acetaminophen and autism spectrum disorders in children. This was effectively a prenatal use study, and it was done on recall. The researchers were in Spain, and they recruited about 2,600 women, mother-child pairs, during pregnancy, and they asked them what their use of Tylenol or acetaminophen was. And they classified it according to never, once in a while, or persistent. The children were evaluated at the age of 1 year and again at the age of 5 years. And they had about 80% retention, so it's pretty decent. 43% of the children evaluated at age one and 41% were exposed to acetaminophen at some point during the first 32 weeks of pregnancy, which is when brain development occurs most significantly. When assessed at five, exposed children were at a higher risk of hyperactivity and impulsivity. Persistently exposed children, in particular, showed a poorer performance in a computerized test that measured inattention, impulsivity, and visual speed processing. Now, this is significantly important because it looks like there's a dose response. If the children who had the highest doses had the most performance decrement, that starts to look like real linkage. Now, linkage doesn't mean causality. Mechanism of acetaminophen, if I was surprised to learn, is that it actually acts on the cannabinoid receptors in the brain. Now, this creates the potential that it could be disrupting one of the tasks of cannabinoid receptors during neurological development, which is directing the process of how neurons mature and where neurons are pruned. So at least there's a potential mechanism there for this association. There also seemed to be a sex-related phenomenon. Males were more vulnerable during early life to these effects. And of course, we know that there's a prevalence of attention deficit disorder and hyperactivity and even ASD in males, and no one's really quite figured that out. But the researchers in this study suggested that it could be that males' brains are more vulnerable to hormone disruptions. And in fact, these agents are typically endocrine disruptors that affect the androgenic or male-creating parts of the hormonal system. This is a preliminary study that found an association. But let me say that, again, the correlation, which is pretty good, does not mean that the causal mechanism that's being proposed here is correct. Correlation can never prove causality. It takes bench science and placebo studies to do that. So here's an alternative explanation, and I'm trying to teach you a little science here. It's called the third variable problem. So let's suppose that the women who took more acetaminophen were women who had more pain. And so during their pregnancies, something different in their physiology meant they had more pain. And that same thing that was different in their physiology, let's postulate that it was inflammation, led to them using more painkillers. So inflammation equals increased painkillers, but inflammation is also the driver that leads to variations in the neurological development of the various fetuses. So maybe inflammation is that fabled third variable that influences and creates the correlation. So a different cause creates two outcomes, and those two outcomes are associated, but not directly. That's a problem. So now that you understand the third variable problem and the issues around correlation and causality, let's talk about something that's potentially pretty scary. This report called Project Tender, which stands for Targeting Environmental Neurodevelopment Risks, recently appeared in a journal called Environmental Health Perspectives. Now, Project Tender is led by a biosciences professor, Susan Schantz, and she's one of the people who put together this consensus statement. This is basically, it's not really a scientific review paper as much as it's a bunch of scientists getting a little bit political and coming together and saying, we really need to address this. You could look at precedences such as Physicians for Social Responsibility back in the 80s, which was an anti-nuclear group, and see the concept here. There was also the recent group of biologists who got together and came up with a consensus statement regarding the use of CRISPR-Cas9 and sort of created a gentleman's agreement that said, hey, let's not start cutting and pasting human DNA until we really know what we're doing, okay? Now, of course, we don't know whether everyone on the planet is actually agreeing with the gentleman's agreement, and I do worry what some lab somewhere in some other place funded by some rich billionaire might be cooking up, but that's the stuff of a number of good science fiction plots that'll be coming up forward. So what are the chemicals that this group is concerned about? Well, lead and mercury, which the data upon is just enormous. Yes, indeed, lead and mercury affect neurocognitive development in children. They're nerve toxins. End of discussion. There is essentially no safe level. Organophosphate pesticides used in agriculture, very widespread, and unfortunately, good correlation data and some good mechanisms in vitro to suggest that, yeah, this is a thing. Organophosphates interfere with acetylcholine, which is one of the basic neurotransmitters. And, of course, again, when we talk about in utero development, we're talking about a subtle and extraordinary complex process that's being driven by gradients of chemicals like neurotransmitters. And if you don't get those ratios just right, and you don't get the right gradient, you don't get the right cellular movement in the direction of those gradients, all kinds of bad things could be happening. Phthalates found in pharmaceuticals, plastics, and personal care products, also a problem. Polybrominated diphenyl ethers. So these are the fire retardants. And oh my God, was this ever a mistake? And it's a big one. Up there with the corn, if you ask me. But that's let me tell you the backstory. So the foams, fire retardants, are added to polyurethane foams, which are in all the furniture. Are added to the bedding. The pajamas are dipped in them. It's all good, right? Children don't burn to death. This is really positive. On the other hand, as the foams degrade and these compounds, these organic compounds get absorbed into the body. They get inhaled, they get swallowed, they get into the body, and in fact, you can measure them in the blood of just about every fertile woman in this country. So we know they're getting into the babies. And these compounds are endocrine disruptors. They affect, again, these sensitive, hormonally driven processes. And really the difference between a hormone and a neurotransmitter is purely contextual. They really are the same sort of compound doing the same sort of job. The question is just whether it's released from a nerve or whether it gets squirted into the bloodstream from a gland. What Project Tender calls for is more research at specifically how we can mitigate exposures and identifying which compounds are the least safe and removing them from the environmental exposure of children. This is also a political issue in a sense, because people who live and work in the agricultural sector are often exposed to high doses of this. Many of those agricultural workers, at least here in California, are young women of childbearing age, and therefore these children are at especial risk to this kind of exposure. And we need to address this problem fairly urgently, at least in exploring and understanding what a truly safe exposure for a gestating woman might be. It's time for some emails. Jackie in Alfred, New York writes, I've been living with stage 4 cancer for 18 years, lots of ups and downs, but generally doing well, though I'm currently on Fosladex. I think this could be the reason my hair is falling out, but I'm not sure. Maybe my thyroid and adrenals are weak. My TSH is 68, within limits 0.27 to 4.2. So I think maybe what she means is 0.68, since she's saying it's within the limits. I did go through radiation in January and February to thoracic vertebrae 4-5 and from the SI joint to L2. So presumably she's got some spinal metastases going on. Do you have any thoughts? Maybe I should have a more comprehensive thyroid test. Well, Jackie, I don't think it's the Fosladex that's causing your hair to fall out. So looking at your thyroid is a good idea. Also, anyone who's living with a long-term cancer will often develop some secondary issues around sleep, possibly around chronic pain, and these can affect the adrenals. So where I would start from a functional medicine standpoint, particularly because you were you mentioned that you were on dexamethasone, is take a look at the saliva curve. And that's a easy-to-do test. You spit into a little tube first thing in the morning, and then 4 hours later, 4 hours after that, 4 hours after that. There are many alternative labs out there that provide this test. Genova, G-A-N-O-V-A, is one. And you would need to get a kit from a functional medicine doctor, or your own physician could create an account and order the kits, but many doctors are so overworked, they're really reluctant to do that. Thyroid testing, yes, also good. I'd be looking at your thyroid conversion. This is a kind of an old naturopathic thing that a lot of conventional doctors don't believe in. This idea that you're maybe making a form of T3 that might interfere with the functioning of the regular T3. You see, we start out making 90% of the thyroid hormone that comes out of our thyroid as a storage form called T4. And then there's a enzyme called D-iodinase, which takes one of the iodines off. Now, 4 iodines is a symmetric molecule, but once you take one off, you have an asymmetric molecule that's called chirality. And basically, you could have a right-handed or a left-handed thyroid hormone. The active thyroid hormone is the one with the 3 iodines. So if there's a problem with that enzyme, the D-iodinase, or other issues in the body, then you may make more of the mirror image version. And just like mirror image writing, it can't be read easily. Well, the body can't easily respond to that mirror image thyroid, although it does occupy the receptor and therefore keep the real thyroid activity from being as high as it should be. Another thing to think about is take a look at your family history. I don't know what age you are, but if you, on the mother's side, have her brothers or maybe her father with male pattern baldness, then a diffuse hair loss in middle age or your early 60s is kind of expected, and that may in fact be all you've got going on. It would be reasonable to take biotin, which is a B vitamin. You have to take a B complex if you're going to do biotin, but then 5 or 10 milligrams of biotin for some people really helps with hair loss and restores hair texture as well. So those would be my suggestions for you, Jackie, in Alfred, New York. And I just want to give you a shout out for being such a survivor. Our next email from Leslie in Santa Cruz. My rheumatoid arthritis. Leslie writes, diagnosed at 52 with rheumatoid arthritis. I'm now aged 59. I'm taking Actemra 2x a month after 6 years of low results and side effects with methotrexate, prednisone, and cortisone injections. Humira, Imbril, Plaquenil. Wow, you've gone through almost all the agents there, Leslie. Symptoms currently are fatigue, pain from normal daily activities, I can't put weight on my wrists, can't bend the ankles or knees very much, can't sleep on the shoulders. The best body position for the last 6 years, lying down, sitting with leg support, or slow walking on level surfaces. Wondering about acid and alkaline foods and the effects on rheumatoid arthritis. I'm wondering if fearful thoughts are contributing to cortisol production and adding to the rheumatoid arthritis. Wow, Leslie. Lots of questions there. Let me start with just some general functional medicine suggestions. Get a vitamin D level, and if your vitamin D level is in the 30s, which is considered normal, start taking vitamin D 4 or 5,000 units a day. You want to drive that vitamin D level up to the mid-70s because that has a modulating effect on autoimmune diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis. Another thing to look at is with respect to diet is do a little bit of elimination diet. You can find that on the website askdrdon.com. And while you're eliminating, also eliminate the nightshade vegetables. And so that would be your tomatoes, eggplants, potatoes, hot peppers, bell peppers. And you can look up a list of nightshade vegetables. There is a substantial proportion, maybe as much as 30% of people with rheumatoid arthritis who will get a lot better if they take the nightshades out of their diet. The elimination diet's also going to take out some of the common inflammatory drivers in food, such as wheat and the wheat gluten, the soy and corn. And these things are all known to cause some amplification of the inflammatory response. Other inflammatory foods are basically anything that raises insulin. So that would be stuff that diabetics shouldn't eat, like sugar and potatoes or starch. These things may be inflammatory. I don't put too much stock in the alkaline acid thing. I don't actually think that the data on that is very persuasive. I think really what's going on is that when people eat a quote-unquote alkaline diet, they're cutting out a lot of the bad things. And yeah, they improve, but it's not because they're making themselves more alkaline. If you want to make yourself more alkaline, take a half teaspoon of bicarbonate in water daily and you will make yourself more alkaline. Or conversely, drink lemon juice in water. Lemon water, although it is acidic, actually causes the system to become more alkaline through a complex set of internal adaptive mechanisms. So the problem with the alkaline acid diet concept is it's too simplified and it really doesn't reflect how the body actually works. That being said, you can check your urine pH in the morning, and if you find that it's not below 5, then you probably do want to either take that bicarbonate or eat a lot more vegetables. And I think you'll find that it doesn't make that much difference for your pain, but I think having alkaline urine is useful in several other ways physiologically. So I'm not saying you shouldn't do that, but I'm saying that the logic behind a lot of what is said is probably incorrect. With respect to management of rheumatoid arthritis, some alternative things to think about looking into would be low-dose naltrexone, which is a anti-inflammatory agent, and it can also really improve your response to pain medications, which is, since it's an opiate antagonist, a little counterintuitive, but the body is full of counterintuitive mechanisms, and this is just yet another example of that. This from Andre in Santa Cruz. Organic sulfur crystals. Dear Don, hi, I miss you on the radio. I've called in the past. I have melanoma and have had 4 surgeries. The last one was in a lymph node. My acupuncturist suggested organic sulfur crystals. What's your opinion? I'm a 51-year-old female, vegetarian. I weigh about 108 pounds, and all over I'm in good health. I've cut out a lot of sugar and carbs, taking probiotics, proteolytic enzymes, and Chinese herbs, trying to eat more raw sauerkraut, and I make grain smoothies daily. I would love to be cancer-free. Well, Andre, let me just comment on the sulfur crystals. You probably are getting a lot of dietary sulfur as a vegetarian. Foods like leeks, garlic, onions have high levels of sulfur in a very bioavailable form. And I think that that's providing adequate sulfur for detoxification. But increasing those foods, if you don't eat a lot of them, would be a good idea. I'm not entirely sure how bioavailable organic sulfur crystals are. And I think getting it from food is probably a smarter way to do it. So I'm going to put a thumbs down on the organic sulfur crystals and double down on the onions and garlic. Judy in Madison, Alabama writes, Dear Dr. Don, thank you so much for replying to my email concerning fainting when ill. You gave me the information and self-help I was hoping for. I'm leaning towards the orthostatic hypotension, especially when I combine it with my 40-year-old varicose veins in both legs. I didn't put it in my first email because I didn't realize it might be significant. In addition to your advice, I think I might sleep in low compression knee highs when ill. I think that's a really good idea, Judy. Also, to answer your question, my blood pressure is totally normal. I don't take any prescriptions drugs. I listen to your podcast while walking 2 to 3 miles a day. Thanks again for your advice with this problem and the others you have solved for me by giving advice to others. Judy. Well, thank you, Judy in Alabama, for the shout out. I really appreciate it. We are continuing here on the podcast to do exactly that. John in Monterey writes, Kyphosis. I'm pretty sure my hip bone is hitting my rib cage, especially when jogging. I was told a brace might stop this. Any suggestions? Wow, John, that would be a little bit unusual, unless you've got some collapse fractures in your vertebral column. But perhaps you do, you don't say. Kyphosis is a situation where usually in the upper thoracic spine, people hunch forward. It's usually caused by collapse fractures of the thoracic vertebrae. And that can be quite extreme. People can develop almost a complete right angle of the thorax. And the primary issue that it creates is that it compresses the lungs and creates some dead space there in the lungs. And sometimes people are more prone to pneumonia and, of course, have more problems exercising. I don't think a brace is necessarily the answer here, but again, I think your problem is one that would need to be evaluated in person for someone to give you meaningful advice. Daniel in Thompson, Connecticut writes, Hi, Dr. Don. I work on sewer pumps and wear rubber gloves, but may on occasion have a hole in a glove allowing unknown substances to come in contact with my hand, which might have an abrasion. I've never had a problem and am in good health, but do worry about the unknown. Is a healthy immune system able to combat surface contact with such substances on, say, a small cut? Thank you for your years of helping myself and others with awareness of the need for good nutrition. Daniel, what I would suggest are these new Band-Aids that I've been seeing that basically are a sticky plastic, and they seal very well all the way around, and they have a little bit of gauze in the center. And that would be, I think, ideal if you do have a cut or an abrasion on your hands to have that on over it when you're working. In general, the immune system is very good at dealing with poop bugs, But, you know, obviously you can get an infection, and sometimes the amount of bacteria might be too overwhelming for your immune system. So, you know, keeping poop out of your cuts is really an important thing to do. Another thing you might try is wearing two layers of gloves. I don't know if you how much dexterity you need if you're wearing just a lightweight latex or nitrile glove, but they do make thicker versions of that, and double gloving is something that we've done in medicine for a long time. It's a little counterintuitive. You want to put a slightly larger glove on first and then a smaller glove on top of that, and that helps protect you, and it also makes there not so much looseness, so you can get a better grip on things. And believe me, in surgery, we like to get a good grip on whatever we're cutting on. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this edition of Ask Dr. Dawn, and I want to encourage you to contact us and send your questions. You can email us by going to the website, askdrdawn.com, and clicking on the Contact Us button. You can also send me a message at my Twitter account, and my Twitter handle is at AskDrDawn. Until next time, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.